200,000 Edsels the first year. There may be an aborigine somewhere in a remote rainforest who hasn't yet heard that things fail to turn out that way. To be precise, 2 years, 2 months, and 15 days later, Ford had sold only 109,466 Edsels, and, beyond a doubt, many hundreds, if not several thousands, of those were bought by Ford executives, dealers, salesmen, advertising men, assembly line workers, and others who had a personal interest in seeing the car succeed. The 109,466 amounted to considerably less than 1% of the passenger cars sold in the United States during that period. And on November 19, 1959, having lost, according to some outside estimates, around $350 million on the Edsel, the Ford company permanently discontinued its production. How could this have happened? How could a company so mightily endowed with money, experience, and presumably brains have been guilty of such a monumental mistake? Even before the Edsel was dropped, some of the more articulate members of the car-minded public had come forward with an answer. An answer so simple and so seemingly reasonable that, though it was not the only one advanced, it became widely accepted as the truth. The Edsel, these people argued, was designed, named, advertised, and promoted with a slavish adherence to the results of public opinion polls and of their younger cousin, motivational research, and they concluded that when the public is wooed in an excessively calculated manner, it tends to turn away in favor of some gruffer but more spontaneously attentive suitor. Several years ago, in the face of an understandable reticence on the part of the Ford Motor Company, which enjoys documenting its boners no more than anyone else, I set out to learn what I could about the Edsel debacle, and my investigations have led me to believe that what we have here is less than the whole truth. For although the Edsel was supposed to be advertised and otherwise promoted strictly on the basis of preferences expressed in polls, some old-fashioned snake oil selling methods, intuitive rather than scientific, crept in. Although it was supposed to have been named in much the same way, science was curtly discarded at the last minute, and the Edsel was named for the father of the company's president, like a 19th century brand of cough drops or saddle soap. As for the design, it was arrived at without even a pretense of consulting the polls, and by the method that has been standard for years in the designing of automobiles, that of simply pooling the hunches of sundry company committees. The common explanation of the Edsel's downfall, then, under scrutiny, turns out to be largely a myth in the colloquial sense of that term. But the facts of the case may live to become a myth of a symbolic sort, a modern American anti-success story. The origins of the Edsel go back to the fall of 1948, 7 years before the year of decision, when Henry Ford II, who had been president and undisputed boss of the company since the death of his grandfather, the original Henry, a year earlier, proposed to the company's executive committee, which included Ernest R. Breech, the executive vice president, that studies be undertaken concerning the wisdom of putting on the market a new and wholly different medium-priced car. The studies were undertaken. There appeared to be good reason for them. It was a well-known practice at the time for low-income owners of Fords, Plymouths, and Chevrolets to turn in their symbols of inferior caste as soon as their earnings rose above $5,000 a year, and trade up to a medium-priced car. From Ford's point of view, this would have been all well and good, except that for some reason, Ford owners usually traded up not to Mercury, the company's only medium-priced car, but to one or another of the medium-priced cars put out by its big rivals, Oldsmobile, Buick, and Pontiac, among the General Motors products, and, to a lesser extent, Dodge and DeSoto, the Chrysler candidates. Louis D. Crusoe, then a vice president of Ford Motor Company, was not overstating the case when he said, "We have been growing customers for General Motors." The outbreak of the Korean War in 1950 meant that Ford had no choice but to go on growing customers for its competitors, since introducing a new car at such a time was out of the question. The company's executive committee put aside the studies proposed by President Ford, and their matters rested for 2 years. Late in 1952, however, the end of the war appeared sufficiently imminent for the company to pick up where it had left off, and the studies were energetically resumed by a group called the Forward Product Planning Committee, which turned over much of the detailed work to the Lincoln Mercury Division, under the direction of Richard Craffey, the division's assistant general manager. Craffey, a forceful, rather saturnine man with a habitually puzzled look, was then in his middle 40s. The son of a printer on a small farm journal in Minnesota, he had been a sales engineer and management consultant before joining Ford in 1947, and although he could not have known it in 1952, he was to have reason to look puzzled. As the man directly responsible for the Edsel and its fortunes, enjoying its brief glory and attending it in its mortal agonies, he had a rendezvous with destiny. In December 1954, after 2 years' work, the Forward Product Planning Committee submitted to the Executive Committee a six-volume blockbuster of a report summarizing its findings. Supported by copious statistics, the report predicted the arrival of the American millennium, or something a lot like it, in 1965. By that time, the Forward Product Planning Committee estimated the gross national product would be $535 billion a year, up more than $135 billion in a decade. As a matter of fact, this part of the millennium arrived much sooner than the forward planners estimated. The GNP passed $535 billion in 1962, and for 1965 was $681 billion. The number of cars in operation would be 70 million, up 20 million. More than half the families in the nation would have incomes of over $5,000 a year, and more than 40% of all the cars sold would be in the medium price range or better. The report's picture of America in 1965, presented in crushing detail, was of a country after Detroit's own heart, its banks oozing money, its streets and highways choked with huge, dazzling medium-priced cars, its newly rich, upwardly mobile citizens racked with longings for more of them. The moral was clear. If, by that time, Ford had not come out with a second medium-priced car, not just a new model, but a new make, and made it a favorite in its field, the company would miss out on its share of the national boodle. On the other hand, the Ford bosses were well aware of the enormous risks connected with putting a new car on the market. They knew, for example, that of the 2,900 American makes that had been introduced since the beginning of the automobile age, the Black Crow, 1905, the Average Man's Car, 1906, the Bug Mobile, 1907, the Dan Patch, 1911, and the Lone Star, 1920, among them, only about 20 were still around. They knew all about the automotive casualties that had followed the Second World War, among them Crosley, which had given up altogether, and Kaiser Motors, which, though still alive in 1954, was breathing its last. The members of the Forward Product Planning Committee must have glanced at each other uneasily when, a year later, Henry J. Kaiser wrote in a valediction to his car business, "We expected to toss $50 million into the automobile pond, but we didn't expect it to disappear without a ripple." The Ford men also knew that neither of the other members of the industry's powerful and well-heeled Big Three, General Motors and Chrysler, had ventured to bring out a new standard size make since the former's LaSalle in 1927 and the latter's Plymouth in 1928, and that Ford itself had not attempted to turn the trick since 1938, when it launched the Mercury. Nevertheless, the Ford men felt bullish. So remarkably bullish that they resolved to toss into the automobile pond 5 times the sum that Kaiser had. In April 1955, Henry Ford II, Breech, and the other members of the executive committee officially approved the Forward Product Planning Committee's findings, and, to implement them, set up another agency, called the Special Products Division, with the star-crossed Crafty as its head. Thus the company gave its formal sanction to the efforts of its designers, who, having divined the trend of events, had already been doodling for several months on plans for a new car. Since neither they nor the newly organized Crafty outfit, when it took over, had an inkling of what the thing on their drawing boards might be called, it became known to everybody at Ford, and even in the company's press releases, as the E-car. The E, it was explained, standing for experimental. The man directly in charge of the E-car's design, or, to use the gruesome trade word, styling, was a Canadian, then not yet 40, named Roy A. Brown, who, before taking on the E-car, and after studying industrial design at the Detroit Art Academy, had had a hand in the designing of radios, motor cruisers, colored glass products, Cadillacs, Oldsmobiles, and Lincolns. The word styling is a weed deeply embedded in the garden of automobilia. In its preferred sense, the verb to style means to name. Thus, the Special Products Division's epic efforts to choose a name for the E-car, which will be chronicled presently, were really the styling program, and what Brown and his associates were up to was something else again. In its second sense, says Webster, to style means to fashion in the accepted style. This was just what Brown, who hoped to achieve originality, was trying not to do. So Brown's must have been the anti-styling program. Brown recently recalled his aspirations as he went to work on the new project. Our goal was to create a vehicle which would be unique in the sense that it would be readily recognizable in styling theme from the 19 other makes of cars on the road at that time, he wrote from England, where at the time of his writing he was employed as chief stylist for the Ford Motor Company Limited, manufacturers of trucks, tractors, and small cars. We went to the extent of making photographic studies from some distance of all 19 of these cars, and it became obvious that at a distance of a few hundred feet, the similarity was so great that it was practically impossible to distinguish one make from the others. They were all peas in a pod. We decided to select a style that would be new in the sense that it was unique, and yet at the same time be familiar. While the E-car was on the drawing boards in Ford's styling studio, situated, like its administrative offices, in the company's barony of Dearborn, just outside Detroit, work on it progressed under the conditions of melodramatic, if ineffectual, secrecy that invariably attend such operations in the automobile business. Locks on the studio doors that could be changed in 15 minutes if a key should fall into enemy hands. A security force standing round-the-clock guard over the establishment, and a telescope to be trained at intervals on nearby high points of the terrain where peekers might be roosting. All such precautions, however inspired, are doomed to fail, because none of them provide a defense against Detroit's version of the Trojan horse, the job-jumping stylist, whose cheerful treachery makes it relatively easy for the rival companies to keep tabs on what the competition is up to. No one, of course, is better aware of this than the rivals themselves. But the cloak-and-dagger stuff is thought to pay for itself in publicity value. Twice a week or so, Crafty, head down and sticking to low ground, made the journey to the styling studio, where he would confer with Brown, check up on the work as it proceeded, and offer advice and encouragement. Crafty was not the kind of man to envision his objective in a single revelatory flash. Instead, he anatomized the styling of the e-car into a series of laboriously minute decisions. How to shape the fenders, what pattern to use with the chrome, what kind of door handles to put on, and so on and on. If Michelangelo ever added the number of decisions that went into the execution of, say, his David, he kept it to himself. But Crafty, an orderly-minded man in an era of orderly functioning computers, later calculated that in styling the e-car, he and his associates had to make up their minds on no fewer than 4,000 occasions. He reasoned at the time that if they arrived at the right yes or no choice on every one of those occasions, they ought, in the end, to come up with a stylistically perfect car, or at least a car that would be unique and at the same time familiar. But Crafty concedes today that he found it difficult thus to bend the creative process to the yoke of system, principally because many of the 4,000 decisions he made wouldn't stay put. Once you get a general theme, you begin narrowing down, he says. You keep modifying and then modifying your modifications. Finally, you have to settle on something because there isn't any more time. If it weren't for the deadline, you'd probably go on modifying indefinitely. Except for later, minor modifications of the modified modifications, the e-car had been fully styled by midsummer of 1955. As the world was to learn 2 years later, its most striking aspect was a novel horse-collar-shaped radiator grille, set vertically in the center of a conventionally low, wide front end, a blend of the unique and the familiar that was there for all to see, though certainly not for all to admire. In two prominent respects, however, Brown or Crafty, or both, lost sight entirely of the familiar, specifying a unique rear end, marked by widespread horizontal wings that were in bold contrast to the huge longitudinal tail fins then captivating the market, and a unique cluster of automatic transmission push buttons on the hub of the steering wheel. In a speech to the public delivered a while before the public had its first look at the car, Crafty let fall a hint or two about its styling, which he said made it so distinctive that, externally, it was immediately recognizable from front, side, and rear, and internally, it was the epitome of the push-button era, without Wild Blue Yonder Buck Rogers concepts. At last came the day when the men in the highest stratum of the Ford hierarchy were given their first glimpse of the car. It produced an effect that was little short of apocalyptic. On August 15, 1955, in the ceremonial secrecy of the styling center, while Crafty, Brown, and their aides stood by smiling nervously and washing their hands in air, the members of the Forward Product Planning Committee, including Henry Ford II and Breech, watched critically as a curtain was lifted to reveal the first full-size model of the e-car, a clay one with tin foil simulating aluminum and chrome. According to eyewitnesses, the audience sat in utter silence for what seemed like a full minute, and then, as one man, burst into a round of applause. Nothing of the kind had ever happened at an intercompany first showing at Ford since 1896, when old Henry had bolted together his first horseless carriage. One of the most persuasive and most frequently cited explanations of the Edsel's failure is that it was a victim of the time lag between the decision to produce it and the act of putting it on the market. It was easy to see, a few years later, when smaller and less powerful cars, euphemistically called compacts, had become so popular as to turn the old automobile status ladder upside down, that the Edsel was a giant step in the wrong direction. But it was far from easy to see that in fat, tail-finny 1955. American ingenuity, which has produced the electric light, the flying machine, the Tin Lizzy, the atomic bomb, and even a tax system that permits a man, under certain circumstances, to clear a profit by making a charitable donation, has not yet found a way of getting an automobile on the market within a reasonable time after it comes off the drawing board. The making of steel dies, the alerting of retail dealers, the preparation of advertising and promotion campaigns, the gaining of executive approval for each successive move, and the various other gavotte-like routines that are considered as vital as breathing in Detroit and its environs usually consume about 2 years. Guessing future tastes is hard enough for those charged with planning the customary annual changes and models of established makes. It is far harder to bring out an altogether new creation like the e-car, for which several intricate new steps must be worked into the dance pattern, such as endowing the product with a personality and selecting a suitable name for it, to say nothing of consulting various oracles in an effort to determine whether, by the time of the unveiling, the state of the national economy will make bringing out any new car seem like a good idea. Faithfully executing the prescribed routine, the Special Products Division called upon its Director of Planning for Market Research, David Wallace, to see what he could do about imparting a personality to the e-car and giving it a name. Wallace, a lean, craggy-jawed pipe puffer with a soft, slow, thoughtful way of speaking, gave the impression of being the platonic idea of the college professor, the very steel die from which the breed is cut, although, in point of fact, his background was not strongly academic. Before going to Ford in 1955, he had worked his way through Westminster College in Pennsylvania, ridden out the Depression as a construction laborer in New York City, and then spent 10 years in market research at Time. Still, impressions are what count, and Wallace has admitted that during his tenure with Ford, he consciously stressed his professorial air for the sake of the advantage it gave him in dealing with the bluff, practical men of Dearborn. "Our department came to be regarded as a semi-brain trust," he says, with a certain satisfaction. He insisted, typically, on living in Ann Arbor, where he could bask in the scholarly aura of the University of Michigan, rather than in Dearborn or Detroit, both of which he declared were intolerable after business hours. Whatever the degree of his success in projecting the image of the e-car, he seems, by his small eccentricities, to have done splendidly at projecting the image of Wallace. "I don't think Dave's motivation for being at Ford was basically economic," his old boss, Craffy, says. "Dave is the scholarly type, and I think he considered the job an interesting challenge." One could scarcely ask for better evidence of image projection than that. Wallace clearly recalls the reasoning, candid enough, that guided him and his assistants as they sought just the right personality for the e-car. "We said to ourselves, let's face it, there is no great difference in basic mechanism between a $2,000 Chevrolet and a $6,000 Cadillac," he says. "Forget about all the ballyhoo," we said, "and you'll see that they are really pretty much the same thing. Nevertheless, there's something. There's got to be something in the makeup of a certain number of people that gives them a yen for a Cadillac, in spite of its high price, or maybe because of it. We concluded that cars are the means to a sort of dream fulfillment. There's some irrational factor in people that makes them want one kind of car rather than another, something that has nothing to do with the mechanism at all, but with the car's personality, as the customer imagines it. What we wanted to do, naturally, was to give the e-car the personality that would make the greatest number of people want it. We figured we had a big advantage over the other manufacturers of medium-priced cars because we didn't have to worry about changing a pre-existent, perhaps somewhat obnoxious personality. All we had to do was create the exact one we wanted from scratch. As the first step in determining what the e-car's exact personality should be, Wallace decided to assess the personalities of the medium-priced cars already on the market, in those of the so-called low-priced cars as well, since the cost of some of the cheap cars' 1955 models had risen well up into the medium price range. To this end, he engaged the Columbia University Bureau of Applied Social Research to interview 800 recent car buyers in Peoria, Illinois, and another 800 in San Bernardino, California, on the mental images they had of the various automobile makes concerned. In undertaking this commercial enterprise, Columbia maintained its academic independence by reserving the right to publish its findings. Our idea was to get the reaction in cities among clusters of people, Wallace says. We didn't want a cross-section. What we wanted was something that would show interpersonal factors. We picked Peoria as a place that is Midwestern, stereotyped, and not loaded with extraneous factors, like a General Motors glass plant, say. We picked San Bernardino because the West Coast is very important in the automobile business, and because the market there is quite different. People tend to buy flashier cars. The questions that the Columbia researchers fared forth to ask in Peoria and San Bernardino dealt exhaustively with practically everything having to do with automobiles, except such matters as how much they cost, how safe they were, and whether they ran. In particular, Wallace wanted to know the respondents' impressions of each of the existing makes. Who, in their opinion, would naturally own a Chevrolet, or a Buick, or whatever? People of what age? Of which sex? Of what social status? From the answers, Wallace found it easy to put together a personality portrait of each make. The image of the Ford came into focus as that of a very fast, strongly masculine car, of no particular social pretensions that might characteristically be driven by a rancher or an automobile mechanic. In contrast, Chevrolet emerged as older, wiser, slower, a bit less rampantly masculine, and slightly more distingué, a clergyman's car. Buick gelled into a middle-aged lady, or at least more of a lady than Ford, sex in cars having proved to be relative, with a bit of the devil still in her, whose most felicitous mate would be a lawyer, a doctor, or a dance band leader. As for the Mercury, it came out as virtually a hot rod, best suited to a young buck racing driver. Thus, despite its higher price tag, it was associated with persons having incomes no higher than the average Ford owners. So no wonder Ford owners had not been trading up to it. This odd discrepancy between image and fact, coupled with the circumstance that, in sober truth, all four makes looked very much alike and had almost the same horsepower under their hoods, only served to bear out Wallace's premise that the automobile fancier, like a young man in love, is incapable of sizing up the object of his affections in anything resembling a rational manner. By the time the researchers closed the books on Peoria and San Bernardino, they had elicited replies not only to these questions, but to others, several of which, it would appear, only the most abstruse sociological thinker could relate to medium-priced cars. Frankly, we dabbled, Wallace says. It was a dragnet operation. Among the odds and ends that the dragnet dredged up were some that, when pieced together, led the researchers to report, By looking at those respondents whose annual incomes range from $4,000 to $11,000, we can make an observation. A considerable percentage of these respondents, to a question about their ability to mix cocktails, are in the somewhat category on the ability to mix cocktails. Evidently, they do not have much confidence in their cocktail mixing ability. We may infer that these respondents are aware of the fact that they are in the learning process. They may be able to mix martinis or Manhattans, but beyond these popular drinks, they don't have much of a repertoire. Wallace, dreaming of an ideally lovable e-car, was delighted as returns like these came pouring into his Dearborn office. But when the time for a final decision drew near, it became clear to him that he must put aside peripheral issues like cocktail mixing prowess and address himself once more to the old problem of the image. And here, it seemed to him, the greatest pitfall was the temptation to aim, in accordance with what he took to be the trend of the times, for extremes of masculinity, youthfulness, and speed. Indeed, the following passage from one of the Columbia reports, as he interpreted it, contained a specific warning against such folly. Offhand, we might conjecture that women who drive cars probably work and are more mobile than non-owners and get gratifications out of mastering a traditionally male role. But there is no doubt that whatever gratifications women get out of their cars and whatever social imagery they attach to their automobiles, they do want to appear as women, perhaps more worldly women, but women. Early in 1956, Wallace set about summing up all of his department's findings in a report to his superiors in the Special Products Division. Entitled, "The Market and the Personality Objectives of the E-Car," and weighty with facts and statistics, though generously interspersed with terse sections in italics or capitals from which a hard-pressed executive could get the gist of the thing in a matter of seconds, the report first indulged in some airy, skippable philosophizing, and then got down to conclusions. What happens when an owner sees his make as a car which a woman might buy, but is himself a man? Does this apparent inconsistency of car image and the buyer's own characteristics affect his trading plans? The answer, quite definitely, is yes. When there is a conflict between owner characteristics and make image, there is greater planning to switch to another make. In other words, when the buyer is a different kind of person from the person he thinks would own his make, he wants to change to a make in which he, inwardly, will be more comfortable. It should be noted that conflict, as used here, can be of two kinds. Should a make have a strong and well-defined image, it is obvious that an owner with strong opposing characteristics would be in conflict. But conflict also can occur when the make image is diffuse or weakly defined. In this case, the owner is in an equally frustrating position of not being able to get a satisfactory identification from his make. The question, then, was how to steer between the Scylla of a too definite car personality and the Charybdis of a too weak personality. To this, the report replied, "Capitalize on imagery weakness of competition," and went on to urge that, in the matter of age, the e-car should take an imagery position neither too young nor too old, but right alongside that of the middling Oldsmobile, that in the matter of social class, not to mince matters, the e-car might well take a status position just below Buick and Oldsmobile, and that in the delicate matter of sex, it should try to straddle the fence, again along with the Protean Olds. In sum, and in Wallace typography, the most advantageous personality for the e-car might well be the smart car for the younger executive or professional family on its way up. Smart car. Recognition by others of the owner's good style and taste. Younger, appealing to spirited but responsible adventurers. Executive or professional. Millions pretend to this status, whether they can attain it or not. Family, not exclusively masculine. A wholesome, good role. On its way up. The e-car is faith in you, son. We'll help you make it. Before spirited but responsible adventurers could have faith in the e-car, however, it had to have a name. Very early in its history, Crafty had suggested to members of the Ford family that the new car be named for Edsel Ford, who was the only son of old Henry, the president of the Ford Motor Company from 1918 until his death in 1943, and the father of the new generation of Fords, Henry II, Benson, and William Clay. The three brothers had let Crafty know that their father might not have cared to have his name spinning on a million hubcaps, and they had consequently suggested that the special products division start looking around for a substitute. This it did, with a zeal no less emphatic than it displayed in the personality crusade. In the late summer and early fall of 1955, Wallace hired the services of several research outfits, which sent interviewers armed with a list of 2,000 possible names to canvass sidewalk crowds in New York, Chicago, Willow Run, and Ann Arbor. The interviewers did not ask simply what the respondent thought of some such name as Mars, Jupiter, Rover, Ariel, Arrow, Dart, or Ovation. They asked what free associations each name brought to mind, and having got an answer to this one, they asked what word or words was considered the opposite of each name, on the theory that, subliminally speaking, the opposite is as much a part of a name as the tail is of a penny. The results of all this, the Special Products Division eventually decided, were inconclusive. Meanwhile, Crafty and his men held repeated sessions in a darkened room, staring, with the aid of a spotlight, at a series of cardboard signs, each bearing a name, as, one after another, they were flipped over for their consideration. One of the men thus engaged spoke up for the name Phoenix, because of its connotations of ascendancy, and another favored Altair, on the ground that it would lead practically all alphabetical lists of cars, and thus enjoy an advantage analogous to that enjoyed in the animal kingdom by the aardvark. At a certain drowsy point in one session, somebody suddenly called a halt to the card flipping and asked, in an incredulous tone, "Didn't I see Buick go by 2 or 3 cards back?" Everybody looked at Wallace, the impresario of the sessions. He puffed on his pipe, smiled an academic smile, and nodded. The card-flipping sessions proved to be as fruitless as the sidewalk interviews, and it was at this stage of the game that Wallace, resolving to try and wring from genius what the common mind had failed to yield, entered into the celebrated car-naming correspondence with the poet Marianne Moore, which was later published in The New Yorker and still later in book form by the Morgan Library. "We should like this name, to convey, through association or other conjuration, some visceral feeling of elegance, fleetness, advanced features and design," Wallace wrote to Miss Moore, achieving a certain feeling of elegance himself. "If it is asked, who among the gods of Dearborn had the inspired and inspiriting idea of enlisting Miss Moore's services in this cause, the answer, according to Wallace, is that it was no god, but the wife of one of his junior assistants, a young lady who had recently graduated from Mount Holyoke, where she had heard Miss Moore lecture. Had her husband's superiors gone a step further and actually adopted one of Miss Moore's many suggestions, intelligent bullet, for instance, or utopian turtle top, or bullet cloisonné, or pastelogram, or mongoose civique, or a Dante con moto. Description of a good motor?" Miss Moore queried in regard to this last. "There is no telling to what heights the e-car might have risen." But the fact is that they didn't. Dissatisfied with both the poet's ideas and their own, the executives in the special products division next called in Foot, Cone, and Belding, the advertising agency that had lately been signed up to handle the e-car count. With characteristic Madison Avenue vigor, Foot, Cone, and Belding organized a competition among the employees of its New York, London, and Chicago offices, offering nothing less than one of the brand new cars as a prize to whoever thought up an acceptable name. In no time at all, Foot, Cone, and Belding had 18,000 names in hand, including Zoom, Zip, Benson, Henry, and Droff. If in doubt, spell it backward. Suspecting that the bosses of the Special Products Division might regard this list as a trifle unwieldy, the agency got to work and cut it down to 6,000 names, which it presented to them in executive session. "There you are," a Foot, Cone man said triumphantly, flopping a sheaf of papers on the table. 6,000 names, all alphabetized and cross-referenced. A gasp escaped Crafty. "But we don't want 6,000 names," he said. "We only want one." The situation was critical, because the making of dies for the new car was about to begin, and some of them would have to bear its name. On a Thursday, Foot, Cone, and Belding canceled all leaves and instituted what is called a crash program, instructing its New York and Chicago offices to set about independently cutting down the list of 6,000 names to 10, and to have the job done by the end of the weekend. Before the weekend was over, the two Foot, Cone offices presented their separate lists of 10 to the Special Products Division, and by an almost incredible coincidence, which all hands insist was a coincidence, four of the names on the two lists were the same. Corsair, Citation, Pacer, and Ranger had miraculously survived the dual scrutiny. Corsair seemed to be head and shoulders above everything else, Wallace says. Along with other factors in its favor, it had done splendidly in the sidewalk interviews. The free associations with Corsair were rather romantic. Pirate, swashbuckler, things like that. For its opposite, we got Princess, or something else attractive on that order. Just what we wanted. Corsair or no Corsair. The E-car was named the Edsel in the early spring of 1956, though the public was not informed until the following autumn. The epical decision was reached at a meeting of the Ford Executive Committee held at a time when, as it happened, all three Ford brothers were away. In President Ford's absence, the meeting was conducted by Breech, who had become chairman of the board in 1955. And his mood that day was brusque, and not one to linger long over swashbucklers and princesses. After hearing the final choices, he said, "I don't like any of them. Let's take another look at some of the others." So they took another look at the favored rejects, among them the name Edsel, which, in spite of the three Ford brothers' expressed interpretation of their father's probable wishes, had been retained as a sort of anchor to windward. Breech led his associates in a patient scrutiny of the list until they came to Edsel. "Let's call it that," Breech said with calm finality. There were to be four main models of the E-car, with variations on each one, and Breech soothed some of his colleagues by adding that the Magic Four, Corsair, Citation, Pacer, and Ranger might be used, if anybody felt so inclined, as the sub-names for the models. A telephone call was put through to Henry II, who was vacationing in Nassau. He said that if Edsel was the choice of the executive committee, he would abide by its decision, provided he could get the approval of the rest of his family. Within a few days, he got it. As Wallace wrote to Miss Moore a while later, "We have chosen a name. It fails somewhat of the resonance, gaiety, and zest we were seeking, but it has a personal dignity and meaning to many of us here. Our name, dear Miss Moore, is Edsel. I hope you will understand." It may be assumed that word of the naming of the E-car spread a certain amount of despair among the Foot, Cone, and Belding backers of more metaphorical names, none of whom won a free car, a despair heightened by the fact that the name Edsel had been ruled out of the competition from the first. But their sense of disappointment was as nothing compared to the gloom that enveloped many employees of the Special Products Division. Some felt that the name of a former president of the company, who had sired its current president, bore dynastic connotations that were alien to the American temper. Others who, with Wallace, had put their trust in the quirks of the mass unconscious, believed that Edsel was a disastrously unfortunate combination of syllables. What were its free associations? Pretzel? Diesel? Hard sell? What was its opposite? It didn't seem to have any. Still, the matter was settled, and there was nothing to do but put the best possible face on it. Besides, the anguish in the Special Products Division was by no means unanimous, and Crafty himself, of course, was among those who had no objection to the name. He still has none, declining to go along with those who contend that the decline and fall of the Edsel may be dated from the moment of its christening. Crafty, in fact, was so well pleased with the way matters had turned out that when, at 11 o'clock on the morning of November 19, 1956, after a long summer of thoughtful silence, the Ford Company released to the world the glad tidings that the E-car had been named the Edsel. He accompanied the announcement with a few dramatic flourishes of his own. On the very stroke of that hour, on that day, the telephone operators in Crafty's domain began greeting callers with Edsel Division instead of Special Products Division. All stationery bearing the obsolete letterhead of the division vanished and was replaced by sheaves of paper headed Edsel Division. And outside the building, a huge stainless steel sign reading Edsel Division rose ceremoniously to the rooftop. Crafty himself managed to remain earthbound, though he had his own reasons for feeling buoyant. In recognition of his leadership of the E-car project up to that point, he was given the august title of Vice President of the Ford Motor Company and General Manager, Edsel Division. From the administrative point of view, this off-with-the-old, on-with-the-new effect was merely harmless window dressing. In the strict secrecy of the Dearborn test track, vibrant, almost full-fledged Edsels, with their name graven on their superstructures, were already being road-tested. Brown and his fellow stylists were already well along with their designs for the next year's Edsel. Recruits were already being signed up for an entirely new organization of retail dealers to sell the Edsel to the public. And Foote, Cone, and Belding, having been relieved of the burden of staging crash programs to collect names and crash programs to get rid of them again, was already deep in schemes for advertising the Edsel, under the personal direction of a no less substantial pillar of his trade than Fairfax M. Cone, the agency's head man. In planning his campaign, Cone relied heavily on what had come to be called the Wallace prescription. That is, the formula for the Edsel's personality as set forth by Wallace back in the days before the big naming bee. The smart car for the younger executive or professional family on its way up. So enthusiastic was Cone about the prescription that he accepted it with only one revision, the substitution of middle-income family for younger executive. His hunch being that there were more middle-income families around than young executives, or even people who thought they were young executives. In an expansive mood, possibly induced by his having landed an account that was expected to bring billings of well over $10 million a year, Cone described to reporters on several occasions the kind of campaign he was plotting for the Edsel. Quiet, self-assured, and avoiding as much as possible the use of the adjective new, which, though it had an obvious application to the product, he considered rather lacking in cachet. Above all, the campaign was to be classic in its calmness. "We think it would be awful for the advertising to compete with a car," Cone told the press. "We hope that no one will ever ask, Say, did you see that Edsel ad? In any newspaper or magazine or on television. But instead, that hundreds of thousands of people will say and say again, man, did you read about that Edsel? Or, did you see that car? This is the difference between advertising and selling. Evidently enough, Cohn felt confident about the campaign and the Edsel. Like a chess master who has no doubt that he will win, he could afford to explicate the brilliance of his moves even as he made them. Automobile men still talk, with admiration for the virtuosity displayed and a shudder at the ultimate outcome of the Edsel Division's drive to round up retail dealers. Ordinarily, an established manufacturer launches a new car through dealers who are already handling his other makes and who, to begin with, take on the upstart as a sort of sideline. Not so in the case of the Edsel. Crafty received authorization from on high to go all out and build up a retail dealer organization by making raids on dealers who had contracts with other manufacturers, or even with the other Ford Company divisions, Ford and Lincoln Mercury. Although the Ford dealers, thus corralled, were not obliged to cancel their old contracts, all the emphasis was on signing up retail outlets exclusively dedicated to the selling of Edsels. The goal set for Introduction Day, which after a great deal of soul-searching was finally established as September 4, 1957, was 1,200 Edsel dealers from coast to coast. They were not to be just any dealers, either. Crafty made it clear that Edsel was interested in signing up only dealers whose record showed that they had a marked ability to sell cars without resorting to the high-pressure tricks of borderline legality that had lately been giving the automobile business a bad name. We simply have to have quality dealers with quality service facilities, Crafty said. A customer who gets poor service on an established brand blames the dealer. On an Edsel, he will blame the car. The goal of 1,200 was a high one, for no dealer, quality or not, can afford to switch makes lightly. The average dealer has at least $100,000 tied up in his agency, and in large cities, the investment is much higher. He must hire salesmen, mechanics, and office help, buy his own tools, technical literature, and signs, the latter costing as much as $5,000 a set, and pay the factory spot cash for the cars he receives from it. The man charged with mobilizing an Edsel sales force along these exacting lines was J.C. Larry Doyle, who, as general sales and marketing manager of the division, ranked second to Crafty himself. A veteran of 40 years with the Ford Company, who had started with it as an office boy in Kansas City and had spent the intervening time mainly selling, Doyle was a maverick in his field. On the one hand, he had an air of kindness and consideration that made him the very antithesis of the glib, brash denizens of 1,000 automobile rows across the continent. And on the other, he did not trouble to conceal an old-time salesman's skepticism about such things as analyzing the sex and status of automobiles, a pursuit he characterized by saying, "When I play pool, I like to keep one foot on the floor." Still, he knew how to sell cars, and that was what the Edsel division needed. Recalling how he and his sales staff brought off the unlikely trick of persuading substantial and reputable men who had already achieved success in one of the toughest of all businesses to tear up profitable franchises in favor of a risky new one, Doyle said not long ago, "As soon as the first few new Edsels came through early in 1957, we put a couple of them in each of our 5 regional sales offices. Needless to say, we kept those offices locked and the blinds drawn. Dealers in every make for miles around wanted to see the car, if only out of curiosity, and that gave us the leverage we needed. We let it be known that we would show the car only to dealers who were really interested in coming with us. And then we sent our regional field managers out to surrounding towns to try to line up the number one dealer in each to see the cars. If we couldn't get number one, we'd try for number 2. Anyway, we set things up so that no one got in to see the Edsel without listening to a complete one-hour pitch on the whole situation by a member of our sales force. It worked very well. It worked so well that by midsummer 1957, it was clear that Edsel was going to have a lot of quality dealers on introduction day. In fact, it missed the goal of 1,200 by a couple of dozen. Indeed, some dealers in other makes were apparently so confident of the Edsel's success, or so bemused by the Doyle staff's pitch, that they were entirely willing to sign up after hardly more than a glance at the Edsel itself. Doyle's people urged them to study the car closely and kept reciting the litany of its virtues. But the prospective Edsel dealers would wave such protestations aside and demand a contract without further ado. In retrospect, it would seem that Doyle could have given lessons to the Pied Piper. Now that the Edsel was no longer the exclusive concern of Dearborn, the Ford Company was irrevocably committed to going ahead. Until Doyle went into action, the whole program could have been quietly dropped at any time, at a word from top management. But once the dealers had been signed up, there was the matter of honoring your contract to put out a car, Graffy has explained. The matter was attended to with dispatch. Early in June 1957, the company announced that of the $250 million it had set aside to defray the advance costs of the Edsel, $150 million was being spent on basic facilities, including the conversion of various Ford and Mercury plants to the needs of producing the new cars, $50 million on special Edsel tooling, and $50 million on initial advertising and promotion. In June, too, an Edsel destined to be the star of a television commercial for future release was stealthily transported in a closed van to Hollywood, where, on a locked soundstage, patrolled by security guards, it was exposed to the cameras and the admiring presence of a few carefully chosen actors who had sworn that their lips would be sealed from then until introduction day. For this delicate photographic operation, the Edsel division cannily enlisted the services of Cascade Pictures, which also worked for the Atomic Energy Commission, and, as far as is known, there were no unintentional leaks. "We took all the same precautions we take for our AEC films," a grim Cascade official has since said. Within a few weeks, the Edsel division had 1,800 salaried employees and was rapidly filling some 15,000 factory jobs in the newly converted plants. On July 15th, Edsel's began rolling off assembly lines at Somerville, Massachusetts, Mahwah, New Jersey, Louisville, Kentucky, and San Jose, California. The same day, Doyle scored an important coup by signing up Charles Chrysler, a Manhattan dealer regarded as one of the country's foremost practitioners in his field, who had represented Oldsmobile, one of Edsel's self-designated rivals, before heeding the siren song from Dearborn. On July 22nd, the first advertisement for the Edsel appeared in Life. A two-page spread in plain black and white, it was impeccably classic and calm, showing a car whooshing down a country highway at such high speed that it was an indistinguishable blur. Lately, some mysterious automobiles have been seen on the roads, the accompanying text was headed. It went on to say that the blur was an Edsel being road-tested, and concluded with the assurance, "The Edsel is on its way." 2 weeks later, a second ad appeared in Life, this one showing a ghostly-looking car, covered with a white sheet, standing at the entrance to the Ford Styling Center. This time the headline read, "A man in your town recently made a decision that will change his life." The decision, it was explained, was to become an Edsel dealer. Whoever wrote the ad cannot have known how truly he spoke. During the tense summer of 1957, the man of the hour at Edsel was C. Gale Warnock, director of public relations, whose duty was not so much to generate public interest in the forthcoming product, there being an abundance of that, as to keep the interest at white heat and readily convertible into a desire to buy one of the new cars on or after Introduction Day, or as the company came to call it, Edsel Day. Warnock, a dapper, affable man with a tiny mustache, is a native of Converse, Indiana, who long before Crafty drafted him from the Ford office in Chicago, did a spot of publicity work for county fairs, a background that has enabled him to spice the honeyed smoothness of the modern public relations man with a touch of the old carnival pitchman's uninhibited spirit. Recalling his summons to Dearborn, Warnock says, "When Dick Crafty hired me back in the fall of 1955, he told me, 'I want you to program the e-car publicity from now to Introduction Day.' I said, 'Frankly, Dick, what do you mean by program?' He said he meant to sort of space it out, starting at the end and working backward. This was something new to me. I was used to taking what breaks I could get when I could get them. But I soon found out how right Dick was. It was almost too easy to get publicity for the Edsel. Early in 1956, when it was still cold, the e-car, Crafty gave a little talk about it out in Portland, Oregon. We didn't try for anything more than a play in the local press, but the wire services picked the story up, and it went out all over the country. Clippings came in by the bushel. Right then, I realized the trouble we might be headed for. The public was getting to be hysterical to see our car, figuring it was going to be some kind of dream car, like nothing they'd ever seen. I said to Crafty, 'When they find out it's got four wheels and one engine, just like the next car, they're liable to be disappointed.' It was agreed that the safest way to tread the tightrope between overplaying and underplaying the Edsel would be to say nothing about the car as a whole, but to reveal its individual charms, a little at a time, a sort of automotive striptease, a phrase that Warnock couldn't with proper dignity use himself, but was happy to see the New York Times use for him. The policy was later violated now and then, purposely or inadvertently. For one thing, as the pre-Edsel Day summer wore on, reporters prevailed upon Crafty to authorize Warnock to show the Edsel to them, one at a time, on what Warnock called a peekaboo or you've-seen-it-now-forget-it basis. And for another, Edsels loaded on vans for delivery to dealers were appearing on the highways in ever-increasing numbers, covered fore and aft with canvas flaps that, as if to whet the desire of the motoring public, were forever blowing loose. That summer, too, was a time of speech-making by an Edsel foursome, consisting of Crafty, Doyle, J. Emmett Judge, who was Edsel's director of merchandise and product planning, and Robert F. G. Copeland, its assistant general sales manager for advertising, sales promotion, and training. Ranging separately up and down and across the nation, the four orators moved around so fast and so tirelessly that Warnock, lest he lose track of them, took to indicating their whereabouts with colored pins on a map in his office. Let's see. Crafty goes from Atlanta to New Orleans, Doyle from Council Bluffs to Salt Lake City, Warnock would muse of a morning in Dearborn, sipping his second cup of coffee, and then getting up to yank the pins out and jab them in again. Although most of Crafty's audiences consisted of bankers and representatives of finance companies, who it was hoped would lend money to Edsel dealers, his speeches that summer, far from echoing the general hoopla, were almost statesmanlike in their cautious, even somber references to the new car's prospects. And well they might have been, for developments in the general economic outlook of the nation were making more sanguine men than Crafty look puzzled. In July 1957, the stock market went into a nosedive, marking the beginning of what is recalled as the recession of 1958. Then, early in August, a decline in the sales of medium-priced 1957 cars of all makes set in, and the general situation worsened so rapidly that, before the month was out, Automotive News reported that dealers in all makes were ending their season with the second-largest number of unsold new cars in history. If Crafty, on his lonely rounds, ever considered retreating to Dearborn for consolation, he was forced to put that notion out of his mind when, also in August, Mercury, Edsel's own stablemate, served notice that it was going to make things as tough as possible for the newcomer by undertaking a $1 million 30-day advertising drive aimed especially at price-conscious buyers, a clear reference to the fact that the 1957 Mercury, which was then being sold at a discount by most dealers, cost less than the new Edsel was expected to. Meanwhile, sales of the Rambler, which was the only American-made small car then in production, were beginning to rise ominously. In the face of all these evil portents, Crafty fell into the habit of ending his speeches with a rather downbeat anecdote about the board chairman of an unsuccessful dog food company, who said to his fellow directors, "Gentlemen, let's face facts. Dogs don't like our product." As far as we're concerned, Crafty added on at least one occasion, driving home the moral with admirable clarity, a lot will depend on whether people like our car or not. But most of the other Edsel men were unimpressed by Crafty's misgivings. Perhaps the least impressed of all was Judge, who, while doing his bit as an itinerant speaker, specialized in community and civic groups. Undismayed by the limitations of the striptease policy, Judge brightened up his lectures by showing such a bewildering array of animated graphs, cartoons, charts, and pictures of parts of the car, all flashed on a CinemaScope screen, that his listeners usually got halfway home before they realized that he hadn't shown them an Edsel. He wandered restlessly around the auditorium as he spoke, shifting the kaleidoscopic images on the screen at will with the aid of an automatic slide changer, a trick made possible by a crew of electricians who laced the place in advance with a maze of wires linking the device to dozens of floor switches, which, scattered about the hall, responded when he kicked them. Each of the Judge Spectaculars, as these performances came to be known, cost the Edsel division $5,000, a sum that included the pay and expenses of the technical crew, who would arrive on the scene a day or so ahead of time to set up the electrical rig. At the last moment, Judge would descend melodramatically on the town by plane, hasten to the hall, and go into his act. One of the greatest aspects of this whole Edsel program is the philosophy of product and merchandising behind it, Judge might start off, with a desultory kick at a switch here, a switch there. All of us, who have been a part of it, are real proud of this background, and we are anxiously awaiting its success when the car is introduced this fall.